Well, as many of you know, I'm Shirley Newman, Dean of the College of Literature, Science, and the Arts. And I'm very pleased to be able to welcome you here this afternoon to this lecture inaugurating the Werner E. Bachmann Collegiate Professorship of Chemistry. Let me tell you a little bit about the man for whom this professorship is named. Werner Emanuel Bachmann was born in Detroit in 1901. He attended the University of Michigan, where he received a BS degree in chemical engineering in 1923, and a PhD in 1926, one of the quickest PhDs in the history of the institution, obviously, under the direction of Professor Moses Gumberg, another very distinguished member of the faculty of the Department of Chemistry, whom the department celebrated with a wonderful symposium last summer. Professor Bachmann was on the faculty of the Department of Chemistry from 1925, and he served there until his early death in 1951. In 1947, Professor Bachmann was named Moses Gumberg University Professor of Chemistry. Professor Bachmann was an outstanding chemist, and his research program was extensive and significant. Particularly well known is his work with free radicals and molecular rearrangements, his synthesis of the first sex hormone, his study of cancer-inducing compounds, his manufacturing process for powerful explosive RDX, and his contributions to the chemistry of penicillin. During his relatively short career, Professor Bachmann received a number of high honors recognizing his work. He was named to the National Academy of Sciences, was awarded the King's Medal by the British government, was presented with a Certificate of Merit by the President of the United States, and he was given the Naval Ordnance Award. Professor Bachmann's legacy to the Department of Chemistry is significant and lasting, and it is wonderfully appropriate that we have a collegiate chair honoring his contributions. It is a particular pleasure for me today to introduce our honored speaker, Professor Gary Glynn, who is Professor of Chemistry and Professor of Biological Chemistry, and who was named to the Werner E. Bachmann Collegiate Professorship of Chemistry in 1999. Gary Glynn received a BA degree from Rutgers University in 1983 and a PhD degree from Columbia in 1988. He joined the University of Michigan's Department of Chemistry in 1990 and is now widely regarded as a major figure, a leader in the area of chemical biology. Professor Glick has combined research expertise in organic chemistry and in structural biochemistry, a combination which enables him to solve important problems in medicine and biological systems. His record reflects accomplishments in two distinct lines of research. First, he has developed synthetic and physical methods to probe critical questions of nucleic acid structure, dynamics, and folding. And second, he has established an understanding of the molecular basis for the recognition of DNA by pathogenic anti-DNA antibodies, characteristic of the autoimmune disorder, systemic erythematosus. The two lines of research carried out by Dr. Glick are quite independent, and they require different techniques, skills, insights, and knowledge sets. Very few scientists can bring such diverse skills and technology to bear on scientific issues, and his achievements in this have already been recognized by numerous awards and honors. He received a National Science Foundation Young Investigator Award, a Junior Faculty Research Award from the American Cancer Society, a National Arthritis Foundation Investigator Award, a Camille Dreyfus Teacher Scholar Award, and an appointment as a research fellow of the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation. He is a co-principal investigator on the NIH-funded Chemistry Biology Training Grant at the University of Michigan, and he has served as an ad hoc member of the bioorganic Chemistry Study Section of the NIH, as well as assuming the position of co-editor of Current Protocols and nucleic acid chemistry. This, I have to say, is an outstanding career for somebody 10 years out of the end of his postdoctoral fellowship. In addition to being an outstanding researcher, Dr. Glick is a dynamic and very effective teacher who has contributed a great deal to the development of a new curriculum in chemical biology at the graduate level. Dr. Glick's ability to excel as a teacher while developing and rapidly making highly significant contributions in two distinct lines of research, all within a few years of initiating his own independent research program, is remarkable. His accomplishments are clear and compelling, and his promise for the future truly exceptional. He's clearly one of the best minds in chemistry of his generation. I am very happy to present to you today Professor Gary D. Glick, whose lecture is entitled Research and Discovery at the Interface of Chemistry, Biology, and Medicine. A short question and answer period will follow the lecture, after which you are invited to join all of us, including Dr. Glick, and to have conversations with Dr. Glick in the assembly hall, which is located straight through these doors and across the corridor. I'm going to call on Professor Glick in a moment, but before that, I'm going to call on the chair of the Department of Chemistry, Professor Joel Marino, who has a small presentation that he wants to make to Professor Glick.
Thank you, Dean Newman. I just want to make a few comments, two things about Gary and present him with a plaque. I wasn't around to know Werner Bachmann, but I could imagine, knowing his career and knowing Gary's career, that there must have been some similarities between the two. I have to imagine that Bachmann was a very ambitious and dynamic person when he started out, and nothing could stop him in achieving what his goals were. And I think we could all say the same thing about Gary. The other thing I wanted to comment on is the similarity between the way Bachmann fearlessly chose a wide variety of research problems. He worked on everything from penicillin, as Dean Newman said, to an explosive. Gary has similar qualities and approaches. However, I hope you never work on any explosives, at least not in the new chemistry building. But Gary does combine uniquely, I think, a variety of traditional disciplines and moving ahead into the future trends of science. And certainly he's had a tremendous impact on our department in the area of chemical biology. Right from the beginning, he helped drive us into that direction. Where he's going to drive us next, I don't know. I hope it's a good thing. So Gary, I'd like to present this plaque here on behalf of the Department of Chemistry.
Professor of Chemistry, and again, I'd like to thank you, Dean Newman, the members of the college, the members of the administration for this distinction. My ability to get things done at Michigan, to be quite frank, has been closely tied to two groups of individuals, and before I begin today, I just wish to acknowledge them and thank them. The first is my research group, members of which both past and present. It is their hard work, their skill, their dedication, they're being able to take what often may be perceived as far-fetched ideas and turn it into reality. And in fact, that's what we're really here today to honor. And second, I would like to thank my colleagues, both in the chemistry department at the medical school, particularly those in biological chemistry, the departments of internal medicine, and the departments of pathology, for creating an environment where scholarship, interdisciplinary research, and collaborative research really can flourish. I really think this is special about Michigan. It's really probably one of the most enjoyable things and one of the reasons that gets me excited each day I come to work. So what I'd like to do in the remaining time is actually tell you about a third area of research, something that's been poking around for the last 4 years. None of this is published. And after I arrived at Michigan, I started reading about a family of disorders, or diseases known as autoimmune disorders. And the prototype autoimmune disorder is lupus. Now, lupus is a disease that afflicts up to about a million people in the United States and Canada. And it primarily afflicts young women in their childbearing years. And for reasons we don't know, African Americans, for example, have a much higher incidence of lupus relative to other races. And we actually don't understand the molecular basis or the etiology of lupus, but we do know that it is, in humans, a disease that's characterized by periods of flares and remissions. And in fact, certain hormonal and environmental agents, such as UV light, can incite flares in this disease. Now, the manifestations of lupus can be very mild, such as an arthritis. They can progress to more severe complications, such as vascular inflammation or vasculitis. And in severe lupus, patients will develop something known as nephritis or glomerulonephritis, and this is a kidney inflammation. Roughly speaking, about 50% of all lupus patients will develop this nephritis, and roughly half of those will die within 10 years of diagnosis. One of the things that characterizes lupus is a hyperactivated immune system and an increase in the number of lymphocytes or immune cells in peripheral organs. And one of these types of cells are B cells. B cells are cells that produce antibodies. And some of the antibodies that are produced in lupus bind a whole range of different proteins and different macromolecules, ranging from nucleic acids, nucleic acid protein complexes, to connective tissues and cells, and to even to proteins. However, lupus is the only condition known to man, at least, where one can generate antibodies to double-stranded DNA, and for this reason, this is actually a very good diagnostic marker to about 70% accuracy. Moreover, these antibodies to both double-stranded and single-stranded DNA, in fact, are the pathogenic agents in this kidney inflammation. They are the molecular agents, if you will, that cause the kidney damage and inflammation that leads to the morbidity and mortality associated with this disease. And a cartoon depicting how this happens is shown here. As an organic chemist, I actually had to learn where your kidneys are. The artist at UMC helped me out. And within your kidneys are substructures known as glomeruli, and these, simply put, are filtration devices. So blood enters here. Through this capillary tubing, filtration occurs, waste products are removed here, blood exits in this efferent arteriole. And on the surface of this membrane, during the process of circulation, antibody DNA complexes can deposit on this membrane. This membrane is rich in collagen 4, and collagen 4 and DNA have a very high nonspecific affinity. And after these antibodies deposit there, they can recruit complement and other inflammatory molecules and lead to a local inflammatory response. And to give you an idea of what I'm talking about, this is a cross-section of a glomerulus. This is a healthy glomerulus. It has a relatively round structure. These little red dots here are red blood cells. And you can see some open capillary space. And in a diseased glomerulus, it is filled with antibody. It's filled of, in fact, not just red blood cells, but these are inflammatory cells, so-called polymorphonuclear leukocytes. This is, in fact, a dysfunctional kidney. The current treatments for lupus are centered on nonspecific therapies. The problem in treating this disease is that the subset of disease-causing or pathogenic lymphocytes or pathogenic B and T cells cannot be identified. Therefore, we have no way to target the disease-causing cells. And so therapies include nonspecific cell-killing agents. So for example, steroids and anti-inflammatories are used for mild disease, and cytotoxic agents, or molecules that will kill cells, are used for more severe lupus. And the problem is that these cytotoxic agents, again, have no specificity, so both normal cells and diseased cells are killed. And the current therapy, or rather the best therapy for this, for lupus nephritis, is this molecule, cyclophosphamide, and I bring that up here simply because a lot of the protocols for the safe use of this disease were developed here at Michigan in the rheumatology division by Joe McKean, David Fox, and others. But I think the chemists in the audience can see that this is a bisalkylating agent. This is a real severe poison. So clearly there is a need for better therapies. And the goal of the research that was initiated some 4 years ago was to identify compounds that could control lupus without the side effects, the broad toxicities, and the immunosuppression that limits current therapeutic regimes. Now, how do you go about doing this? Well, since there are no drug targets, the approach that we employed was really twofold. First, we use a technology known as combinatorial chemistry, where very large collections of molecules can be synthesized and presumably screened rather quickly. This is very important here, since we really didn't know what we were looking for. We didn't really have a lead candidate to build on. And the second part, which is important here, is the screening. What we decided to look for were molecules that can kill cells. And hopefully, we would be able to identify one that had some specificity or selectivity for the disease-causing lymphocytes in lupus. These other two molecules, which you'll see here, are promising therapies that I won't have time to discuss today, but in fact, they are in clinical trials right now for lupus. The molecule that we identified, which I will term for this talk just BZ, and I'll explain to you what that is in a second, has a profound ability to kill cells. So here are some healthy cells that are growing in culture, and they are treated with a solvent control. And here are cells that were treated with BZ. And this BZ, in part, is a form of cell death known as apoptosis. This is a pre-programmed form of cell death, an orderly type of cell death. And this morphology, where the cells sort of bleb up and the chromatin condensation occurs, is very characteristic of this form of cell death, other than non-specific cell death, which is often termed necrosis. So here is the structure of BZ. BZ is a benzodiazepine. Benzodiazepines typically include molecules such as diazepam or valium and clonazepam, which most of us are probably familiar with in one form or another. This molecule differs by them by this large piece here, which is not present here. And in fact, because that large piece is there, one renders the cytotoxic properties, the first cytotoxic properties, but more importantly, it also abolishes all the sedative properties of valium. So why do we use benzodiazepines? It's really twofold. First, large libraries of benzodiazepines were available in the early 1990s, primarily through the fine work of John Ellman at the University of California at Berkeley, and actually simultaneously the group at Park Davis, led then by Mike Pavia, who developed the technology of combinatorial chemistry. The second reason why we chose benzodiazepines is because in addition to valium, or in addition to sedative properties, benzodiazepines have a wide range of medicinal uses. They're what medicinal chemists often call privileged structures. And the identification of a benzodiazepine with useful cytotoxic properties would hence define a novel structure-activity relationship in a family of molecules that generally do not have many non-specific side effects. So while this compound kills cells in culture, there are no good culture models of, or ex vivo models of lupus and the pathology of lupus. So that necessitated very early on in this project that we begin experiments in animals. And the first group of experiments that we performed were conducted in a mouse model of lupus known as the MRL-LPR model of lupus. And these experiments were conducted by an MD PhD student in the laboratory, Jeff Bernardsky, in collaboration with a rheumatology fellow, Tarek Rao, who's working for Bruce Richardson, and Ray Young, also in the Division of Rheumatology. And what we did was we took a group of young mice, and we treated them with this benzodiazepine, the concentration that gave a circulating concentration that had a resemblance to the activity of the concentrations we've used in vitro, and we'll talk a little bit about that later. And what we noticed was a very specific effect, that this benzodiazepine has a very specific activity on just T cells within the spleen. Okay, T cells are one part of the immune effector lymphocytes. And in particular, this effect was concentrated on CD4-positive lymphocytes and a special group of lymphocytes known as double-negative T cells. This compound did not affect B cell numbers or CD8 T cells or any of the other non-lymphocytic components that make up the spleen. So this was actually very encouraging. But more importantly, this benzodiazepine, when you do this experiment side by side in normal immune animals, absolutely has no effect on the composition of the lymphoid system or the immune system in normal animals. And this is the type of selectivity that, in fact, we're looking for. An agent that can affect autoimmune lymphocytes without affecting normal lymphocytes. So it led to the clear hypothesis that dosing these mice for a prolonged period of time may improve disease by selectively removing T cells. And it's important because in these animals, T cells are the pathogenic agents in lupus. They help drive the autoimmune response. So Jeff tested that hypothesis, and the experimental design is shown here. We got a group of mice. No joke, we actually kept these at the back of the room. We had no mice running around the chemistry building. And we started dosing them at a relatively young age, and we looked at the severity of the disease relative to mice receiving control. We wanted to assess these mice for how well their kidneys worked. We looked at their kidney histologies. We looked at the makeup of the immune system, and whether or not this compound, after prolonged dosing, had a general toxic effect. So, how does one measure efficacy in this sort of study? Well, one of the ways we did that was to measure the amount of protein in the urine. When your kidneys fail, they excrete protein, and that could actually be relatively easily quantified by a little dipstick. And you can see here that as a function of time, the mice that receive the benzodiazepine stay relatively healthy or disease-free, whereas the control mice progressively get more sick. And there is a very good statistically significant difference between the treatment and the control group. We also measured another non-specific marker, if you will, of kidney function. This is known as blood urea nitrogen. This is, all, as I said, a marker of kidney function. And any number above 30 milligrams per deciliter is an indication of renal distress. And you can see that the mice that were treated stayed relatively healthy, where the mice that were not treated got sick. And these sort of measures, if you will, of renal function were confirmed by histology. So here is an example of a representative glomerulus from these control mice. All these blue cells here are inflammatory cells. This glomerulus is in fact scarred over. The necrosis and sclerosis have already occurred. And the mice that receive the benzodiazepine, while not having necessarily perfect glomerular morphology, actually remain relatively healthy. And you can see that there's a good structure here, there are red blood cells, and there is a statistically significant difference when comparing all the control mice to all the benzodiazepine treated mice. So that was actually very encouraging. Something else that popped out of this study that we didn't expect is shown here. These MRL-LPR mice are in fact models for generalized systemic autoimmunity. They develop all sorts of diseases, one of which is rheumatoid-like arthritis. In fact, this is one of the earliest models of rheumatoid arthritis. And what I show you here are two specimens of bones taken from the back paws of control and treatment animals. So this pink here, this dark pink, is bone, this is cartilage. And all of these cells here, these purple cells, as you can see also surrounding, are inflammatory cells. And in fact, you can start to see the inflammatory cells eating away at the articular cartilage, and this is the beginning of a bone erosion. By contrast, now we see benzodiazepine-treated mice have relatively normal, relatively little inflammation. As a matter of fact, here, this is about as much what we term, the technical term for this is synovitis, the amount of inflammatory cells that infiltrates the joint space. It's actually relatively normal. So this was an added effect, and while I don't have time to discuss it today, experiments with collaborators have demonstrated, in fact, activity of this compound in a number of very important models of inflammatory diseases. And now I think one of the important sort of money questions, is this toxic? Is this going to be any better, potentially any better, than cyclophosphamide? So we conducted a complete analysis of the animals, all the organs and all the major organ systems in these animals. We find that sort of the general appearance of the mice don't change. complete blood count, so the circulating lymphocytes are not decreased, and perhaps most importantly is that long-term treatment doesn't affect bone marrow. Okay? A lot of your, or virtually all of your immune cells generate hematopoiesis within the bone marrow, and many cytotoxic agents, anti-cancer agents, wipe out bone marrow. As a matter of fact, cyclophosphamide, if one was going in for a bone marrow treatment, you'd start off on very high doses of cyclophosphamide to wipe out your bone marrow. And very gratifying, is that this compound absolutely has no effect there. So that was a particularly important result. We had a look through histopathology at all the non-lymphoid organs, all the major organ systems, including the brain, absolutely no abnormalities. And one of the other things that was available to us was take a look at liver function. This is actually using the clinical pathology labs at the hospital. This compound doesn't affect liver function. And in aggregate, we observed no evidence of any adverse cytotoxicity. So let's get in a little bit of how this can be going on. And there's a lot of data on this slide, but I want to just concentrate on two things. First, we took a look at the amount of these pathogenic antibodies in circulation. And in the treated mice, they are less. The levels of these antibodies are statistically less than the control mice. And what's interesting is that is occurring in a background where the total antibody, normal antibody levels, if you will, are unaltered. So that implies a selective effect. The second thing that's important here is, just as we observed in the short-term, this one-week study that I showed you early on, long-term treatment with this compound does not also decreases T cells. Okay? And so the question is, how could this be occurring? What is special about these T cells that would allow them to be selectively reduced? So I needed to learn something in the group. We needed to learn something about T cell biology. So here is the life and death of a T cell. When T cells are resting, if you will, they're not proliferating, they can encounter antigen. And these antigens bind on something to a protein on the surface of a T cell known as a T cell receptor. And once that receptor antigen complex is formed, the T cell becomes activated. And it is driven, that activation leads to the beginning of a number of important signal transduction pathways that leads to a proliferating state. Okay? Now, this antigen here could be influenza virus. Okay? It could be a peptide from influenza virus, and this could be an encounter between a T cell and an antigen that could help fight off infection. After the infection is over and the antigen goes away, this T cell may die through apoptosis, or it may actually go on to a memory cell to help us remember, or help the immune system remember what this infection looks like. And that's useful in fighting the infection if the same pathogenic agent is encountered another time. Let's pretend this antigen now is not influenza virus, but perhaps a protein on the surface of cardiac tissue. Okay. Now, we don't want our immune system fighting cardiac tissue. I think that's clear. And so the immune system has developed a mechanism of tolerance, peripheral tolerance, if you will, to basically turn off or to kill T cells that recognize self or autoantigens. That's shown at the top. You can imagine that cardiac tissue will always be presented to the immune system at a high concentration because it persists throughout life. And normally, this would induce, the second encounter with an antigen will induce a process known as activation-induced cell death. Now, in these mice, this process is defective due to a mutation of a protein known as FAS. That's unimportant for the time being, or for in the big context here. But the reason I mention this is that, in effect, we seem to be killing these cells. Okay? This compound is able to kill these cells. And it led to the hypothesis that treatment with the benzodiazepine can rescue the defect in activation-induced cell death that's present in these animals. And so Jeff Benarski and Tonio Papari, who was then a fellow in the laboratory, now he's an assistant professor, Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology. I like to say I'm the only male organic chemist with a gynecologist in his lab, actually tested that hypothesis, and the results are shown here. So we isolated T cells from MRL animals, And we challenged them twice with an antigen, if you will, or a stimulation signal. And because of this defect in this activation of B cell death due to a mutation in this protein FAS, these cells don't die. And that's shown here in the green. As a control, or as reference, BALB-C T cells were also employed, and BALB-C mice have normal immune function. So they are not defective in activation-induced cell death. And in fact, just by activation, these cells will die over time. However, this defect in the green line can be rescued when one adds the benzodiazepine. So in effect, it appears that activation sensitizes T lymphocytes to this compound such that they can be selectively killed. And so, again, this line shows the rescue of that defect. So we were gratified by this. We're starting to develop a molecular understanding and a molecular mechanism for a potential therapeutic. But the problem is lupus, there's really, even though the MRL mice are a good model of lupus, they're not a great model of lupus. They're, in fact, not the only model of lupus. And probably the oldest model of lupus is the NZB-NZW model of lupus. This model of lupus was developed by mating New Zealand black mice with New Zealand white mice to eventually, after successive rounds of breeding, to develop this autoimmune phenotype displayed in the NZB-NZW animals. And so Neil Blatt, another MD PhD student in the laboratory, in collaboration with Roscoe Warner, a research scientist in the Department of Pathology under the direction of Kent Johnson and Peter Ward, decided to look at the effect of this compound in this animal model of lupus. So basically, any drug that's on the market in lupus has to pass through both this MRL and the NZB model of lupus. So in this model of pathology very closely resembles the human disease. Females die at around 8 months of age, and one can see changes in the kidney as early as around 4 months of age. So we performed the same type of study, but on a much larger cohort of animals, to take a look at the effect on, again, kidney function, kidney histology, and so on and so forth. And what's important to mention before I go on here is that unlike the first model that I discussed, B cells are the important players here. This is a B cell dominant disease. And so in effect, if you will, if we took our benzodiazepine and said, look, here are these MRL mice, T cells are dominant, go kill the T cells and leave everything else alone, and then said, look, now let's go into this NZB model, just kill the B cells and leave everything else alone. We want to see if this compound has the ability to do that. And again, very gratifyingly, it does. So again, I show you, in this case, a little bit more histology. So the control mice, again, look very similar to one of the early slides I showed you for a sick glomerulus. This is a immunofluorescence slide where we're actually staining for deposited immunoglobulin just for our antibody. You can see that glomerulus is entirely lit up. And C3 is a marker for active inflammations, complement component 3. You can see, again, inflammation, antibody deposit, and that's reflected in the overall morphology of this glomerulus. And a representative one, representative histology from the benzodiazepine-treated mice, look roughly normal. There's very little antibody deposit, very little active inflammation, and again, this glomerular morphology is maintained. So now the question in selectivity. Show you some more histology. Now we're not talking about kidney histology, but these are actual cross-sections of the spleen. Now, in the spleen, antibody reactions occur in structures shown here in these light brown, known as germinal centers. In germinal centers are activated B cells, and in these activated B cells, a process of somatic mutation, high affinity antibodies are being formed. These germinal centers are surrounded by another zone of B cells, and this other zone of B cells is not activated. Okay? So we have two different B cell compartments here, components. And in NZB animals, these germinal centers are pathologically expanded. This is where the bad antibodies are made. And you can see that after treatment, there are very few of these germinal centers present. As a matter of fact, on this particular cross-section, there are none. Okay? And in fact, Under normal conditions where there is not an active immune response going on in a mouse or in you or me, there are no germinal centers, and this would be viewed as normal. And in fact, if one adds all this up and does image analysis, the germinal centers are reduced in size and number by about 50% relative to the control. And there are many, many, many mechanisms by which that reduction can occur. But the evidence on the right part, which I'll go through in a second, favors direct killing of the cells within the germinal centers. So this is a germinal center, stained here in red, and the green are dead cells. And you can see that in control, very few of the germinal center cells are dying, but in the treated mice, there are many, many more dead cells or dying cells within these germinal centers. So then, we can propose a model for disease improvement in that it's been previously established, it's well established actually, that pathogenic antibodies develop in germinal centers. These B cells within germinal centers are activated much in the way that the T cells are activated in the previous model. And we would propose that the benzodiazepine is able to lead to the disease improvement that I demonstrated by selectively reducing activated, perhaps just the autoreactive, if you will, B cells. And then just to summarize this, results from both of these groups of animal experiments, that in these NZB animals, which I showed you, we kill B cells. In data I didn't show you, that leads to a direct decrease in the antibody titers, the bad players, and that leads to a decrease in end organ damage. In the MRL animals, we kill CD4 positive T cells, and through an indirect process, that leads to a decrease in B cells, which leads to a decrease in autoantibodies and end organ damage. So in effect, we have an agent that selectively is able to kill or shows apparent selectivity for the pathologically expanded lymphocytes in two models of lupus. Now, recognizing that cytotoxic agents are useful in a variety of different diseases, Tonio Papari, in fact, used this benzodiazepine to study its effect on two models of solid tumors. And as a gynecologist, he was interested in ovarian cancer, and through a collaborative effort, we became interested in neuroblastoma. So ovarian cancer is the fourth leading cause of cancer mortality in women. At least 50% of the patients are relatively young women. And the problem with this disease, it's asymptomatic in its early phases, and when it does present, the late stage survival rate is very low. It's advanced disease. Neuroblastoma is the most common form of extracranial cancer in children. And the median age of survival is about 22 months. And because of the production of proteins and gene products that lead to cell survival, our current drugs are really ineffective against this disease. And so I just want to show you some preliminary data. So the first thing we wanted to do is take a look at and see if, in fact, this compound can kill cancer cells. And so what I show you here on this part of the figure is a well-established cancer drug, cisplatin. And these are ovarian cancer cells. And you can see that therapeutic concentration, this cisplatin, in fact, was obtained from the IV tubing of a patient in the cancer center here. Cisplatin is very effective at killing ovarian cancer. However, two types of resistance can arise in these cancer cells. One is something known as mutations or null P53, and the other is the overexpression of survival proteins, in this case, BCLX-long. And in fact, these two resistance tricks by the cancer render cisplatin ineffective. And you need cisplatin roughly at concentrations here in order to kill these cells. Unfortunately, that would kill the patient as well. But what's remarkable is that this benzodiazepine doesn't care at all about these mutations. And you see a nice dose response curve, and in fact, BZ is able to kill both these two resistance strains as well as the wild type pan strain. And we're planning experiments this summer to test this in an animal model of ovarian cancer. And we've gone a little bit further in neuroblastoma. Again, we were able to show nice efficacy in a dose response sense in killing these cells in vitro. And in a model of neuroblastoma, and these experiments were done in collaboration with Valerie Castle's lab in the Department of Pediatrics here, that we, once tumors were in, inoculated into new mice and the tumors were established, that this benzodiazepine is able to reduce the rate of tumor growth to a statistically significant extent. And this five-fold reduction is very similar to what one sees with etoposide, which is a current treatment for neuroblastoma. So we would also, this summer, like to expand these studies out into a larger cohort of mice. And then to conclude, I want to talk a little bit about how this works. So there's really two groups of questions, or at least we have considered two groups of questions with respect to the mechanism of action of this agent. So the first is that I presented data that benzodiazepine appears selective against pathologically expanded groups of lymphocytes. And it raises the question, the real question is, does this benzodiazepine alter normal immune function? Is this an immunosuppressive agent? And in fact, we've been able to do, the answer to the question is no. There's not enough time to go through all the data, but if one actually does a series of experiments where we take normal mice and we continue to dose them with our benzodiazepine, and then challenge them with either B-cell specific antigens or T-cell specific antigens, there's no change in the autoantibody titer. So this agent truly appears selective for the autoimmune response. And now the question is, since we have proposed that the activation state of lymphocytes modulates the activity of this compound, how does this occur, and then why are activated cells more sensitive? Now, for the few Chem 210 students here and for my organic colleagues, we feel comfortable drawing arrows. You know, so we know where electrons are. And so as an organic chemist proposes a mechanism problem, we like to think at the atomic level. Cell biology doesn't quite think at that level. And in fact, we look at things like this. And this is the simplified view of cell death. So this is, you know, to an organic chemist that likes to know where every atom is in a molecule, this is a very scary problem. And we have invested an enormous amount of effort over the last year or so to elucidate the mechanism of action of this compound, or to study the mechanism of this compound. And so while this is a relatively complicated slide, and there are many, many alternative pathways, we decided to maybe take a little bit more rational approach. We asked, what are some common markers and signals in B-cell apoptosis? Apoptosis is the death of lymphocytes. They include kinases and phosphatases and reactive oxygen species like hydroxyl radical. Changes in intracellular calcium levels can trigger B-cell apoptosis. The mitochondria, in fact, are central regulators of cell death and cell survival. Caspases, which are proteases that actually are the executioners, if you will, of cell death, they are proteases that cleave up other proteins and cells. Finally, expression of genes gene products are themselves cell death executioners, are all part of this machinery. And to show you a very, very simplistic view, a very, very condensed view of what's going on, when one treats cells, and these are unactivated cells, with our benzodiazepine, there is a profound change in reactive oxygen. There's an increase in reactive oxygen. Based on our data, we believe this is superoxide. And there are two we have identified, and this is really work of, again, Jeff Bednarski and Tony Opapari. We've identified two pathways of cell death. One is what I would term a nonspecific injury, where the reactive oxygen species leads to lipid peroxidation, and a mitochondrial independent pathway leads to necrosis. While that is occurring, there is another pathway of cell death, that where the reactive oxygen species leads to an increase in intracellular calcium, followed by caspase activation, release of adaptogenic factors from the mitochondria. This is a change in the mitochondrial membrane potential, which allows that to occur, and eventually we lead to cell death. Now, the only way to prevent this or to inhibit this compound is with vitamin E, which is an antioxidant, or with TBAP, which is a manganese porphyrin compound that's believed to react with superoxide very specifically. These two antioxidants can scavenge or quench the reactive oxygen species that's produced by this benzodiazepine. We've also shown that inhibitors of caspases can prevent calcium changes and can prevent caspase activation, but they do not lead to cell survival. So if you turn off this arm of the cell death pathway, this arm takes over. So that's the basic mechanism, if you will, a very simplified version of what happens in just the response of our cells to our benzodiazepine. Now the question is, why are activated cells more sensitive? And just to remind you what I mean by why are activated cells more sensitive, why are these light brown cells killed and while sparing these darker brown B cells, and there are in fact other T cells within this region? And while we have done some reasonable amount of work in animal models by activating their immune systems and looking at selectivity, most of the work has in fact been done in vitro. And we needed to establish an in vitro model. And this model employs a type of B cell, first actually brought up in the laboratory by Omar Omaz, who last summer was an MD PhD rotating student who will join the laboratory this summer through the immunology graduate program. So he got up this Ramos model, and then with Tony and Jeff, performed the following experiments. Now, on this axis is the benzodiazepine, and the y-axis is dead cells. And I perhaps should have mentioned this earlier. I've written here very explicitly apparent benzodiazepine concentration. Some of you medicinal chemistry buffs may notice that the IC50s here are relatively weak. However, this compound binds to the extent of 99.8%. 99.5% to serum albumin, and the effective concentration of free benzodiazepine in solution is in fact in the nanomolar range. So I think the intrinsic potency of this compound is in fact much greater than one sees in these conditions with high serum albumin. So in unactivated cells, and unactivated in this case we're dealing now with B cells, there is a nice dose response that's generated such that increased concentration of the benzodiazepine leads to increased cell death. However, in activated cells, there is a different dose response. And these are activated cells and activated two different ways. Ways are activated are slightly important now. And what's interesting is that there are two distinct, in comparing these sets of lines with this line, there are two distinct concentration regimes that can be noticed. At concentrations of benzodiazepine that have minimal or no activity in unactivated cells, there is profound cell killing in the activated cells, to the extent that at some concentrations, maybe 20 times more cells or a 20-fold increase in cell death. When one gets to very high concentrations of the benzodiazepine, it doesn't matter whether or not this activation stimulus is there. You get the same amount of cell death. So we would propose, or what we think would be going on in the animals, is that the selectivity derived by working at concentrations in this regime. Now, why are these activated cells more sensitive? And one can propose two reasons. It's possible that activation, okay, and that's activation through the B cell receptor, the BCR, basically is a volume knob. It turns up the pathway that I showed you two or three slides ago. Just enhances the cell death pathway. And in fact, we demonstrated that in the unactivated cells, there is a correspondence between the amount of reactive oxygen species produced and the amount of cell death. The more ROS, the more cell death. It's also possible that stimulation through the BCR induces a different cell death pathway. And so we took a look at this, and each of these hypotheses or each of these possibilities. So this is data from a flow cytometer. Cells were incubated with a molecule known as dihydroethidium. It monitors reactive oxygen species. And these green, this is populations of cells. There's 20,000 actual dots here, or some large number of dots. It appears that they're clustered together, and you get sort of this overriding pattern. The red cells here do not have reactive oxygen. These green cells do. And just with 5 micromolar benzodiazepine, 38% of the cells stain positive reactive oxygen. And in fact, under these conditions, these cells will survive. This is not enough to kill the cells. Now, if the stimulation just simply acts as a volume control, we would have predicted that there may have been a larger number through some novel biology that has not yet really been described. Perhaps PCR stimulation turns up reactive oxygen in conjunction with this benzodiazepine. But that's not true. And in fact, our data are most consistent with an alternate pathway. So at very high concentrations of benzodiazepine, whether or not this activation signal is there, cell death occurs by necrosis through this lipid peroxidation. However, at this low concentration of benzodiazepine that in the absence of an activation signal is not cytotoxic, the reactive oxygen species now leads to a calcium influx. We have demonstrated that there is calcium transport from outside the cell to inside the cell. There is caspase activation again, a change in the mitochondria. And at this step here, there is gene expression going on. That's important for the executionary phase later on out to 24 hours. So this pathway is fundamentally different. You'll notice that unlike the unactivated cells where just antioxidants are protective, chelation of extracellular calcium, in this case with a molecule known as BACTA, is also protective against overall cell death, as is inhibition of caspases and inhibition of protein synthesis. Now, while I don't have time today to go into this, we've actually learned quite a bit about what's going on in this era. For example, not only do we have molecules such as vitamin E that can inhibit or that can quench the radicals that are the reactive oxygens species that are produced, we actually have to turn it off completely at its source, and we believe we understand where the reactive oxygen species is intersecting with BCR-stimulated pathway to lead to this cell mechanism that I've shown. So then, just to wrap up, we have defined a proapoptotic benzodiazepine that defines a new structure-activity relationship for benzodiazepines. And we've demonstrated that this molecule will prevent nephritis, which is one of the most clinically significant endpoints in lupus and two of the best animal models of lupus, and that this compound has its effect in animals without any of the adverse side effects that limit current therapies. And the selectivity is modulated by activation and an ROS signal. Again, that's important because if you remember that I mentioned early on, the immune system in both human lupus patients and these animals is hyperactivated. So this benzodiazepine is basically exploiting the natural pathophysiology to achieve the unique selectivity. And so we're currently trying to identify the cellular target, and actually last summer, Katie Johnson, another MD PhD rotating student who's joined the laboratory again through the immunology graduate program, and perhaps one of the most heroic rotation efforts, has demonstrated the subcellular localization of this compound, has made biotinylated probes, and actually has bands on gel, so hopefully we'll, in fact, have this receptor very quickly. In collaboration now with Bill Rausch, we're trying to improve the pharmacodynamics of this compound to improve a bit of the solubility profile, and we hope, just by the way things are going, that within a couple of years at the outside, we'd like to be in human trials. So I'd like to just acknowledge, again, the people who did this work. In fact, if there was no MD PhD program here at Michigan, there would be no, this, I would not be able to present this work to you. Jeff Bednarski, Neil Black, who's actually now in his third year on wards, Antonio Capari, who is now an assistant professor in OBGYN, did virtually all the studies that I showed you. Katie and Omar are starting now, carrying the torch, if you will, and Jenny Beckingham, Christine Ackroyd, Joanne Cleary, Tanya Goodman, and Autumn Kish actually work on the other lupus project and involving antibodies, and Anil Kaur and Bill Goodlock actually study our RNA folding work. And again, I am fortunate to have the ability to collaborate with these individuals here at Michigan and John Allen at Berkeley. And then lastly, I'd like to, look who's up there. That's you. That's right. I'd like to thank my wife, Rachel, for her kindness and her love and support and understanding the husband that at 8 o'clock goes back to his office 5 nights a week. And to Hannah and Jeremy. I'm not sure, Hannah, if you retired in this picture or you're trying to look 5 going on 16. But in any event, I thank you all for coming out today. Dean Newman, Justin Newman, thank you.
I'm sure some of you have questions. Would you address them directly to Professor Newman?
Michael.
Two questions. Gary, does the stereochemistry matter at all in this compound? Maybe three questions. Does it have any sedative properties? And maybe the best of the three, at least the one, how did you get from Elman's library and this to,
yeah.
to so, down this path?
So the first question is, stereochemistry doesn't matter. There is some anti-selectivity at low concentrations. That just, all that tells you is you're looking at two-point binding rather than three-point binding. Second question, no. There's no sedative properties at all. We can give 700 milligrams per kilogram per day for a month and the mice don't fall asleep. And after a month they start to die, but that's for those of you, that's a lot of compound. And then the last question is we actually screened the library for a number of different properties. Cytotoxicity, in fact, was one of them. And we identified this as a molecule with unique selectivity profile. And in fact, in many ways, we got very lucky. Why did we deal with the library? This was when this work started, there weren't very many libraries available. John and I were at an NSF conference in a canoe together, and we started talking. And that's actually what led to this particular collaboration. But benzodiazepines and sort of hedging our bet, as I mentioned earlier on, they have all sorts of activities. They really are privileged structures. They do all sorts of things. And we sort of were trying to mine a gold, an established gold mine, and see if we can find more gold, or a different type of gold.
Gary, you mentioned at the beginning that the naphthalene ring obviously has a big impact on how the reagent works. Have you tested other substitutes there?
So if you put in a nitrogen, you make quinolones, it abolishes nearly all the activity of the compound. Whereas if you go from naphthyl alanine to phenylalanine, you only abolish 50% of the activity. So one of the things we're going to work on with Bill is a real thorough exploration of the diversity that's allowed that position.
Is it a naturally occurring material?
No.
Make it?
A lot of it.
Derek, you talked about the comparison of your compound to cisplatin in ovarian cancer, and cisplatin has a very sort of narrow range in terms of stem cell type cancers, testicular, ovarian. What is the breadth of this? Clearly the mechanisms must be different.
So in vitro, or in cell culture, this compound would kill anything. The question is, what is the appropriate model to judge the extent of efficacy? And really, I think those are in animal experiments. We have been given cells. So virtually all types of cancers that we've tried, we've looked at all the lymphomas. We haven't gone to too many other solid tumors, but we've looked at osteoclasts that people have given us and said nothing kills these cells. I mean, concentrated hydrochloric acid and we will kill the cells. So I think what's happening is that we are engaging a very unique, very conserved, very important part of the cell death machinery, and that leads to these responses that really enables that. And the point at where we engage this machine basically circumvents all the normal resistance mechanisms. So I think it has a wide range of applicability. How useful it is really is going to depend on the selectivity in various models. And I think the usefulness of this compound, so there are some reasons why cancer cells can be viewed sort of as activated lymphocytes. There are a lot of similarities, and I think that that is related to why we see efficacy in those models. How well that is really conserved in other models is really going to be up to experimentation, but it's going to really require animal experiments. I don't think cell culture is going to be useful.
Did you say that the calcium is coming into the cell from the outside, or is the coming from the mitochondria?
No, it's not the
mobility transition.
We don't believe it's coming from the mitochondria because the calcium occurs before the gradient changes occur. So we monitor the gradient changes of the mitochondria with DIOC6 or with JC1. We haven't triggered the permeability transition. And the calcium can, we can prevent the calcium response with extracellular chelators. We've also demonstrated that the compound does not directly act on the ryanodine sensitive or the thapsogarbine sensitive stores that are typically when you release, then you activate the crack channel and lead to the influx. So this, we believe this is the novel lymphocyte receptor calcium channel. And so it would be, there's very interesting calcium biology that I didn't have time to go through. There are profound calcium changes. It would actually be very useful to actually be able to study those, perhaps work with someone that has single cell calcium probes. We have not looked at superoxide dismutase yet, although I don't think it's SOD because the level of the response that we the change and the ROS change and the rate of the ROS change, the extent of the ROS change is so profound, so quick that it is really atypical of what one would expect for background levels of SOD. So I don't think that's it, but that is a formal possibility. It's. We believe, actually, based on work at Camp Lecowinton now, that it is probably related to an NADPH oxidase. Yes.
So you said there's some library where you took this from. What's in this library?
This particular library contains 1,659 benzodiazepines that differ by where this naphthalene ring is, where the chlorine is, and where the hydroxyl group is. So these compounds were, I didn't show my one slide. My combinatorial chemistry slide. But this library was formed in a parallel synthesis fashion in what is termed split and pool synthesis, where you can envision a variety of different starting materials, let's say a red ball, a blue ball, a green ball, are mixed together and put into these three flasks, and the chemical reaction occurs in each one. Now a yellow ball, a blue ball, different blue ball, a red ball, different mixtures, you combine them, you split them, you perform another chemical reaction. By varying the components that make up the benzodiazepine, you make up different benzodiazepines. And then we screen them for a variety of different things.
Are there other questions, Professor? Well, if not, it falls to me on your behalf to thank Gary Vick for a talk that clearly was full of scientific interest to judge from your questions, asked from a base of expertise somewhat greater than my own, and also to thank him for doing such important work, whether or not we are scientists, any of us who have had any contact with individuals who have